Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Man, did you guys see South Park last night? That was so great. Somebody ought to give one of them awards to those guys for the Making Me Laugh prize. If you missed it, you can get it off the Pirate Bay or from South Park Studios here in a couple days or so, I guess. All right. So Will Grigg's going to be back on the show today. Thank goodness. The great Will Grigg. You know what we're going to be talking about. Also, Roy Guttman's going to be on the show. I know, he kind of pisses me off sometimes too. Well, he's a straight news reporter, and I think that he invests power with legitimacy in his mind in ways that I wouldn't always consider healthy. You know, trusting official sources and their views a little too much. And maybe that just means I disagree with him some. But the thing about him is that I really like him, too. He's done some really good work on, say, for example, Bahrain, where America and Saudi Arabia support the murder dictatorship there. And some other things like that. Anyway, boy, was I happy to read his piece in McClatchy yesterday. It was about the talks in Geneva going on right now, the Iran nuclear talks, and about how, man, I can't find anybody at the whole hotel who doesn't believe in this thing, man. That's basically the bottom line. This is happening. This is going to be a thing. I mean, well, we'll see. This is certainly the best chance that America has had, not just to have a nuclear deal. We don't even need a nuclear deal. Iran ain't even making nukes. That's not the thing. But this is huge as far as breaking the ice. This is like hacking off a gigantic piece of Antarctica or something, man. This is like sliding the whole Greenland ice sheet into the sea, breaking the ice here. This is huge. For getting over the American-Iranian Cold War that's been going on since 1979. It's gotta come to an end. And anyway, this, I don't want to get all the way out in front of everybody on it, but I don't have many reasons to believe that it ain't gonna happen. We'll see what Roy can do about that as he comes on to report the news. There's still Israel, and there's still Congress, and there's still the Democrats in the White House who can't really be trusted to do the right thing. But anyway. And then Eric Garris is going to be here to talk about the FBI's investigation of antiwar.com, which, as you know, I've been affiliated with for a long, 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 long time. And what a strange story that is, seriously. Not just because it sort of, kind of, a little bit is about me, but not really, but... well, anyway. We'll talk about it with Eric later on the show. And then I got a couple messages out. I'm trying to get messages to Adam Kokesh. I should have sent him a tweet. Maybe he's sleeping in. I don't know. But I'm trying to reach Adam Kokesh because he's out of jail, apparently. We talked yesterday on the show about how he had pleaded guilty and got out instead of going to prison. Smart. I guess we'll have to do some community service or something. I don't know. Anyway, we'll get Kokesh on the show for you as soon as possible. And by the way, I think tomorrow we'll have Gareth Porter on. He's got a brand new piece. We just didn't have time to fit him in the show today. But he's got a brand new piece about the drone strikes in Pakistan. Oh, sweet. There's Kokesh in my text message button right now there. Gareth has this new piece about the drone strike in Pakistan and what it was really about and the real consequences of it. So that's pretty cool. I've been way negligent at getting Pakistan experts on the show lately. I mean, America's been waging war there still this whole time. But good old Gareth is on the case for us. I don't know what I'd do without Gareth. I don't know what we would do about Gareth. He's great on everything. And by the way, I got Gareth's new book about Iran. I will be sad if the Democrats make a nuclear deal with the Iranians and it makes Gareth's book obsolete. But then again, it'll be all right. He'll just have to add an addendum on there. And, you know, it's not like somebody's going to sew Benjamin Netanyahu's fat, lying mouth shut or anything. So the issue will never really be dead, even if they do break a deal, make a deal. All right, cool. Well, shoot, man. I think probably we should get Kokesh on the show here for a sec. What do you think? It's the Skull Horn Show. Y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. We're joined on the phone by Adam Kokesh from Adam vs. the Man. Hey, Adam, how's it going?
Outstanding. Thanks for having me on today, Scott. Appreciate it.
Hey, I'm happy to have you on. Welcome back to Relative Freedom.
Yeah, exactly.
How was your trip?
Well, it was 4 months in state custody, living off the taxpayer. And it was certainly an interesting, harrowing experience. It was a distinct challenge. And as of my status hearing from yesterday, I was fully expecting to go back to jail for an absolute minimum of 8 weeks pending sentencing. And I was very fortunate to be released. And I have to go back on January 17th for sentencing, but I'm just grateful to be able to talk to people like you freely and be able to communicate again.
Yeah, well, it's certainly good to know that you're out and safe and sound in one piece and breathing fresh air and all that. So you've pleaded guilty and you're awaiting sentencing now. I guess they had been holding you without bail. But can you tell us which charges you've pleaded to? And it's just to clear the air, obviously nobody even thinks this or whatever, but it's not that you've, turned state's witness against anyone else or anything. You've just quit fighting them on the charges against you, basically, right?
On these particular charges, yes, and it's for carrying a rifle or shotgun outside a home and place of business, and unregistered firearm, unregistered ammunition, and possession of marijuana. And it was a really difficult decision. You know, it wasn't one I came to lightly, but, you know, out of consideration for other people that are involved in this, other people in my life, with, you know, consulting with my family, we decided that this was ultimately in the best interest of justice, as well as a good, positive, practical outcome. And as you know, I still have to face charges in Virginia, and I'm not looking forward to dealing with that either. But I'm really grateful for everybody who supported me so far in this endeavor, and it continues, of course. But everybody who wrote me letters when I was in jail, everybody who donated to the Legal Defense Fund, especially everybody who wrote to the judge and the prosecutors and everybody else involved who helped out, who protested and was a part of this. You know, it was really an amazing experience to feel how people came to my support during this time.
Yeah, that is cool. Now, as far as the decision to go ahead and plead guilty, I don't think anybody would blame you for that when you still could be facing prison time or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this case, it's up to 7.5 years minus the 4 months time served. I'm still hypothetically facing.
Yeah, so... you know, listen, this was your idea in the first place. It's not like you owe anyone any more time in jail at all. Hopefully they don't think you owe them any more time.
Well, like I said, ultimately I think this is in the best interest of justice.
Yeah. All right, now, well, and do you feel like you made your point?
Oh, absolutely. And I've certainly stimulated a lot of thought and a lot of people, and I definitely got a good sense of the appreciation for that.
And wow, so still up to 7 years now. Well, geez, I guess you can't really say, but
seven and a half.
So your lawyers think that going ahead and pleading guilty is going to help you out very much, I hope.
Well, you know, I can't comment on any of those legal specifics until after the sentencing. But you know, we're looking forward to getting it past this one way or another.
Yeah. Well. You know, if I was Judge Harry, it'd just be $50 in time served and go about your day, and thanks for the great YouTube video, but I guess we'll see. Now, so how long do you have until the sentence?
Maybe you should be a judge, Scott. I mean, I could see that happening pretty soon here. Yeah, I mean,
wouldn't that be great? Me and Dan Larroquette and all of them, Bull Shannon. And, all right. The black lady, always liked her. What is her name? Marcia Wallace? She's funny. So, how long till you're sentenced?
January 17th.
Oh, okay, that's good. So, we can expect some good episodes of Adam versus the Man, at least in the meantime, right?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to be capable of production-wise. I'm still, like I said, we weren't expecting this at all. You know, I was fully prepared to stay in jail, and we were making plans to do more podcasts from jail, but it's been a lot of fun doing that, and, you know, my wonderful girlfriend, Carrie Webber, has been recording my podcast over the jail phone, so people can go check those out, adamversusdemand.com/podcast, or they can see them in segments on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Adam Kokesh, and really appreciate everybody who's been listening to and sharing some of those videos, and there's some really good stuff lately. I did an interview, actually, with another inmate before I got out. His name's Q. He did it anonymously. That's going to be coming out this week.
Cool.
There was a story I told of another inmate who has some very interesting legal challenges that he's faced, Mr. Glenn Smith, and really appreciate people checking those out and being able to help out some of the inmates that I met who are facing, you know, really much more difficult situations than I ever did.
Yeah, you know, I was just about to ask you what was the most important thing you learned in there, but I guess that's it, right? The stories of these other people being held.
Yeah, and, well, that's a big part of it, you know, seeing what other people are going through, but also having a sense, just having lived through whatever little part of the experience that I did, of the unique challenges that anyone going through the justice system faces. And, you know, one of the tough things really for me was seeing when you're locked up pre-trial, that unless your legal strategy is, well, I'm going to have someone else pay a lawyer who's going to handle everything, you know, they make it very difficult for you to prepare a defense. So that was, you know, that was a big part of it for me. But also, like, through hearing all these guys' stories and seeing what they were going through, you know, really got a unique appreciation for, like I said, just all the different unique challenges that guys face.
Mm-hmm. Well, and overall, do you think most people or anything like most people in there actually did something wrong, like beat the hell out of their wife or something that they deserve to be in there for, or everybody's just accidentally committed some offense against some state regulation?
Well, I will say there's a lot of deception among inmates, understandably, given the
sure.
circumstances.
Yeah. We're all innocent. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, that of course, that's the myth, right, from Shawshank Redemption. You know, everybody in here is innocent, don't you know? But that's not true, and most people are very forthright about what they've been charged with, and generally, you know, people need to be careful about talking about their cases, but there aren't a lot of people going, oh, no, I'm innocent, I shouldn't be here, at least from my experience with the exposure that I had. The vast majority of men and of inmates that I met were pretty upfront about, you know, what they did and, you know, what it meant to be taking their punishment, whether they thought it was legitimate or not. And, you know,
well, I mean, that's what I mean. There's a difference between using a gun on someone and racking a shotgun on video to make a political point, or even just walking down the street with one in your pocket. And so I wonder,
sure.
you know.
In that case, from that perspective, and I understand that's what you're getting at, I don't want to be trying to draw too many conclusions from my experience, because I think the statistics on those counts speak for themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess. I don't know what they are. That's why I was curious. I just imagine there are more people in there for gun charges for just simple possession rather than actually doing something wrong with one, but I don't know.
Well, there were definitely a lot of those, and, you know, I don't want to try to make a survey because I wasn't keeping track of the numbers, and I wasn't looking at other guys' paperwork very often.
Sure.
But if you want to, you know, if you want to look at the numbers, there are a lot of people in for charges there in that sense, similar to what I face. But, yeah. Scott, I'm sorry I got to go. It's all the time I have right now. And, you know, like I said, I'm glad for the opportunity, but, you know, I'm going to be getting a book written in the next 10 weeks before I go to sentencing, and we have that to look forward to. So definitely appreciate the opportunity. If anybody wants to help support me, AdamVersusTheMan.com. You can go to /invest if you want to donate. Like I said, I'm going to have, well, as you probably know from while I was locked up, basically, and I don't mean just by government raiding my house, but from a former staff member, basically all of my money was stolen. The original legal defense funds were stolen, mm-hmm. and we've been trying to get some of that back. But we're going to. I still got to go forward for this case in Virginia. We really need all the help we can get with that. And then when all of this is behind me, getting back into regular production.
Right on. Yeah, you know, I talked with your buddy Drew, right? Drew Phillips. I interviewed him on the show, and I've been trying to remind people that whatever they heard about that, it's in the past, and that your good friend and your dad are handling the money for you now and all that kind of thing. So I hope that the message has gotten out there that whatever problem is over and that people can feel safe in donating again and all that.
Absolutely.
All right, and again, that's AdamVersusTheMan.com/invest. And I'm sorry, go ahead real quick.
Yeah, no, it's just one of the things I really came to appreciate, too, about going to jail is the, you know, the consequences of disruption to your life. You know, if it wasn't for the people that helped pick up the pieces in the last couple of months, and, you know, my dad, I want to, you know, shout out to him. You know, I love you so much, Dad, and you know, I'm really grateful for everybody, Nathan Cox, Kim Wood, Anthony Antonello, Michael Salvi, my girlfriend Carrie Wedler in California, and Jeffrey Phillips in L.A., you know, they've just been incredible when all this went down to help pick up the pieces. But, you know, if it wasn't for them, you know, my life, I'd be coming out of jail with a Metro card and a Department of Corrections ID, and that would be it.
Yep.
And
this bumper music is a coincidence, I swear. Hey, we got to go. That's it. AdamVersusTheMan.com.
Right, thanks,
Adam. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. sir. Now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the Security Theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to this here thing. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at LibertyExpressRadio.com, live 3 to 5 weekdays, as well as No Agenda Radio, NoAgendaStream.com, my own website, ScottHorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003, at ScottHorton.org. And join up the chat room, for crying out loud, I just did. It's ScottHorton.org/chat. Got a good group of people in there today, too. ScottHorton.org/chat. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. For God's sake, retweet me. Share me. Let all your friends know what you're listening to, if you're listening. But I guess if you are, then you are. And if you're not, then you don't even know that I'm saying that anyway, so. All right. Will Grigg coming up. Don't you go nowhere. Hey, if you've never heard Will Grigg, you're going to want to hear this. Will Grigg is great. Will Grigg is part of what makes America great. And he's coming up. And I mean the society, not the nation state. Coming up on the show here in just a second. All right, so now, where the hell is my Saudi nuke story? What the hell is this? It's, was it Jeff Stein? Don't tell me I lost the damn link. I got so much news and not enough time to cover it. It's a shame. Saudi nuke. That ought to be all the keywords I need here. Okay. Here's a link to a thing. So, BBC report. That's what it was. Here, let me just search Google News since you guys are going to be so bad about this. Hey, Google, what are you, retarded or something? I'm looking for the... All right, here. BBC. Well, Haaretz, link into the BBC. Jesus, what is this? All right, Google News. I'm going to take you out back and beat the crap out of you now. Anyway, the story was that the Saudis want to buy a nuke from Pakistan. And here it is. Saudi nuclear weapons on order, according to this Mark Urban fella. I don't know if this is true or not. I guess I should have got Phil Giralli on the line to ask him whether his CIA guys that he still knows tell him whether this is real or not or what. Not that you can always take that to the bank, but you pretty much take Phil's perspective on it to the bank. Saudi nuclear weapons on order from Pakistan. Saudi Arabia has invested in Pakistani nuclear weapons projects and believes it could obtain atomic bombs at will. Well, you know, I don't think that's in dispute.
Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are obviously extremely close and have been. And the Saudis bankroll the hell out of the Pakistani government the same way the Americans do and have for a long time, right? So if the Saudis really wanted a nuke, they could buy one from Pakistan, I assume. I mean, I'm not saying it's a guarantee that the Pakistanis would be willing to sell them. But, I mean, here he's just quoting the head of Israeli intelligence saying, oh, how easy it would be for Saudi Arabia to go buy one. I don't think that means anything. I don't think it means anything that Gary Samore agrees. What the hell is this? Gary Samore, he was one of, he's the guy, wasn't he one of the guys that helped Bush attempt to sabotage the IAEA safeguards agreement review conference things? Or am I thinking of somebody else? I might be thinking of somebody else. Anyway, it does bring up the thing, and maybe this is the point, is it brings up the question about whether an American-Iranian nuclear deal might be more trouble than it's worth. Maybe the status quo of Cold War and constant empty threats is worse than changing everybody else's calculations so that the Saudis think that they need to buy a nuke from the Pakistanis. Although, that's pretty stupid. It's not like Iran even is making nukes. The nuclear deal would be to take their ability to make nukes completely away, so it's not even a worry to even the most paranoid little crybaby lacunic you could find. And, what, like they're an offensive threat? They're just going to roll their tanks into Saudi Arabia, the Iranians? And, you know, the Saudis, maybe they don't want to see Iran's power and influence in the region increase that much, but buying a nuke isn't necessarily the solution to that. Holding nukes. Anyway, I would not take this too seriously, not yet. It doesn't make sense for the Saudis to want to become a nuclear weapon state. They don't have that much weight to throw around. All they've got is more oil than the others, or the ability to produce more per day than the others. So they have more influence over the price than the others. But, come on. Even their military is just a bunch of American welfare equipment sitting there doing nothing. Expanding and contracting out in the desert sun. But the Saudis' military is called the U.S. Army, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Navy. They don't fight. They buy, you know, whatever their military forces are, basically just for internal oppression. So the hell use do they have for a nuke? They don't have that much foreign policy. Yeah, you know, bankrolling some Mujahideen warriors and sending them off to regime change the Baathists in Syria. That makes sense. That's one thing, but I don't know. I guess we'll see. I wouldn't jump the gun, though. And I, you know, whenever BBC or New York Times or anybody like that tries to bring up any sort of nuclear threat, especially one where, oh, the Israelis said you should be concerned, is in the third paragraph, I think you can pretty much take it with a grain of salt. Wait till Gareth Porter's concerned. That's my policy. Hey, Gareth, you concerned about this? Oh, well, there's 700 reasons why not to be. Anyway, we're going to cover this more. We're going to follow up on the Saudi nuke story. Probably tomorrow.
Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him.
That's why I named it that.
Our first guest today is the heroic William Norman Grigg. Will Grigg. That's what they call him. He writes at his great website, Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Hey, really? Bookmark that one. Retweet it. Pass it around. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And the book, of course, is Liberty in Eclipse. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Will?
Scott, it's always great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Good times. Very happy to have you here. Tell me, have the cops raped or murdered anybody in America lately?
I'm sure that's going on even as we speak, but one really conspicuous example of this was publicized just a couple of days ago in Deming, New Mexico, involving a 53-year-old man named Dave Eckert, who last January had the misfortune of coming to the attention of the local police as he pulled out of a parking lot at Walmart. One officer claimed to have seen him fail to come to a full stop and radioed ahead to a second officer to be on the lookout for this brown 1990s vintage car that Mr. Eckert was driving. So he was stopped by the second officer on the basis of a report that he had run through a stoplight, and he was given a traffic citation. And as a result of this stop, Mr. Eckert was taken into custody and spent the next 14 or 18 hours undergoing what can only be described as sexual torture on the orders of the police, with the connivance of medical professionals in Silver City, New Mexico, on the basis of a warrant that was issued by an assistant district attorney by the name of Daugherty. The rationale was that his behavior evinced that he might be smuggling narcotics in his rectal cavity. And after the traffic stop began, a thug scrum of about 12 police officers assembled, one of whom had a canine officer named Leo, who's not certified as a drug dog in New Mexico, hasn't been certified for the last 2 years. He said that Mr. Eckert was known in Hidalgo County, where he resides, as somebody who smuggles drugs in his rectal cavity. And on the basis of what was either unsubstantiated gossip or a lie that was invented at the scene, a affidavit was procured permitting a search of Mr. Eckert's vehicle and also a search of his body cavity to determine if he was indeed concealing narcotics. The search of his vehicle turned up negative, and the search of his body turned up negative as well. As Fletch said in the movie, it was not for a lack of looking, because once he was taken out of the jurisdiction and in violation of the terms of the search warrant to Silver City, he underwent multiple digital rectal exams, at least two abdominal x-rays, three forced enemas, and a colonoscopy. This is all done over his objections, which means that these were acts of object rape. If you invade somebody's intimate anatomy against that person's permission, you're committing object rape. It states as much in the state statutes of every state I've studied on the subject. This was done, once again, on the basis of something that doesn't reach the threshold of reasonable suspicion, much less probable cause. I've got the affidavit here. It was just recently publicized, recently made available by Mr. Eckert's attorneys. And line 5 of this affidavit, which was filed by an officer by the name of Chavez, it states, "While speaking with Mr. Eckert, I did notice that he was avoiding eye contact with me as I asked him for his driver's license, registration, and proof of insurance. He was avoiding eye contact quite possibly because he was looking for the documents. It might be that he wanted to avoid eye contact with the police because he didn't want to provoke the police. That's not suspicious." Line 6 says, "As Mr. Eckert handed me the documents that were requested, I did notice his left hand began to shake, at which time I had Mr. Eckert step out of the vehicle. Now, one of the reasons why Mr. Eckert was acting nervous, I believe, is because the previous September 6th of last year, he went through almost exactly the same experience about two blocks away from his home. He was stopped in his home, which is a little town not far from Deming, and he was told by the police officer that he had a cracked windshield, and he was given a warning rather than a citation. And as he turned to go, the police officer pulled the standard Columbo routine, which is, I just have a few more questions, just one more question. He wanted to engage Eckert in conversation to try to build the traffic stop into a drug search. That's what police are trained to do. If you take a look at the training materials at any post academy, they're encouraged to build every stop. Every contact with the public is to be turned into an investigative opportunity, and owing to the incentives that exist, they almost always become narcotics searches or narcotics investigations. Eckert at that point said, you've told me I'm free to go. Am I free to go? And the deputy who stopped him said, well, that's rude, and on the basis of your rudeness, I'm going to have to search your vehicle. And so they brought in the drug dog, they brought in several other police officers, they impounded his car, they searched it over the course of the next day, and of course that means that he had to pay the impound fees. And it all turned up negative. There was no probable cause, there was no reasonable suspicion, there was no evidence found that he was involved in any way in either consuming or selling narcotics. But he underwent this experience the previous September, and I suspect, on the basis of what I've read in this case, I've read most of the documents that have been made publicly available, is that his attitude was noted, as the commissar famously said in Dr. Zhivago, the fact that he had asserted his rights, however politely, and he had made himself a little bit obnoxious to the sainted enforcement caste there in Hidalgo County and the environs, that he was somebody who was under the scrutiny of the police, which explains why there was more than one police officer keeping tabs on him that night in January, that resulted in another experience where he was understandably nervous. He was under the scrutiny of the police. He'd had bad experiences with them before. His body English, his body language is going to be that of somebody who's uncomfortable in the presence of the police. And quite frankly, what decent person isn't uncomfortable in the presence of an armed stranger who claims a license to inflict aggressive violence on you? But that was line 6 of the affidavit. You go down to line 8. The arresting officer, and by the way, he was never told he was under arrest, which is why he was denied a phone call. He was handcuffed and taken into custody, and he was kept in custody for the better part of a day, but they insist this wasn't an arrest, which is why he wasn't allowed to call an attorney. Line 8 of this affidavit says, while Mr. Eckert was standing outside of the vehicle, I did notice his posture to be erect, and he kept his legs together. And a short time later, I informed Mr. Eckert that a uniformed patrol officer was coming to issue him a citation for the stop sign violation. Several lines later, we read in line 12 of this affidavit, I asked Mr. Eckert if I could search his person for any illegal narcotics and or weapons. At that time, he stated that he had a problem with me searching his person. That, of course, is entirely understandable. You don't want to have your bodily integrity violated. And then the officer said, I then informed Mr. Eckert that an open-air search was going to be conducted on the vehicle and reminded him that he had given me verbal consent to search his vehicle as well. That is a lie. That's something Mr. Eckert denies. I'm of the opinion that where there is a conflict in an account between a citizen and a police officer, you should assume that the police officer is lying, because police officers are trained to lie, they're encouraged to lie, they're allowed to lie with impunity. They face no social or political or professional consequences if they're caught lying. So the preponderance of evidence would dictate that you believe the citizen unless the police officer can corroborate his account. Mr. Eckert says he did not give permission. I believe him. That seems to me to be self-evident. But on the basis of this, and this is a profoundly thin gruel of suspicion, there was an affidavit drawn up and a warrant issued to allow a search not only of the vehicle but of Mr. Eckert's person. But that warrant was limited to Luna County, and it was not enforced in Luna County because when they took him to a local emergency care facility, Dr. Ash, that's the way he's identified in the lawsuit, had the presence of mind and the character to say, what you're requesting of me is illegal, it's unethical, I will not do it, you do not have the legal authority to compel this man to undergo an invasive procedure. That's something you cannot do. So the officer shrugged their shoulders and contacted Assistant DA Daugherty, who suggested that they take him out of the jurisdiction to this clinic in Silver City, where they found doctors of the sort who were compromised by the CIA in Gitmo, the same kind of people. They claim to be doctors, but they're not burdened by Hippocratic scruples in inflicting misery on people. So they took him to this facility in Gila, and he spent the next 14 hours undergoing this invasion of his person in supposed pursuit of narcotics evidence that most likely would not have been admissible if they had found something through this invasive procedure, because the warrant expired at 10 o'clock that evening. none of the procedures apart from the abdominal x-ray were conducted before the end of the time period specified in the warrant, and this was conducted outside the jurisdiction where the warrant was issued. And if you take a look at the warrant furthermore, it doesn't strike me as something that's compatible with the Fourth Amendment requirements that you specify what you're looking for and where you're likely to find it. Because they specified the car was searched, there was no evidence in the car. They made reference to body cavities, the person of Mr. Eckert, but that, of course, doesn't mean that you can conduct invasive probes of his entire digestive system in hopes of finding something that supposedly would have been made obvious through a pat-down or a minimally evasive search of that kind, as if such a thing could exist. This whole exercise was unconstitutional, obviously. More importantly, it was illegal in terms of any moral or ethical principle. It's the sort of thing that's happened more than once in Deming. There's a similar case that occurred with a man named Timothy Young. I don't know that he had to go through the entire suite of procedures up to and including the colonoscopy, but he was stopped for a supposed moving violation. When he turned to go, he was subjected to the Columbo tactic, oh, just one more question, and then you have the same group of people descend upon Mr. Young, including the same uncertified drug-sniffing dog, and he ended up undergoing rectal exams and other degrading and dehumanizing object rape type abuse, supposedly to look for narcotics evidence that wasn't there. And one of the points I made in writing up this story is that Deming, New Mexico, is the headquarters of a Homeland Security Investigations Office and also a task force that was set up when this was declared a high-intensity drug trafficking area about 10 or 12 years ago. The border task force that two of these officers worked for is even more notoriously corrupt than pretty much every other task force of the sort in the country. They're all terribly corrupt. They're all engines of embezzlement and corruption. The one in Deming is notorious because in 2007, a former ICE agent, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department agent by the name of Christopher DeSantis, was fired after he blew the whistle on what would have to be described as embezzlement in the office there. The Border Narcotics Task Force office was padding its statistics and embezzling funds. They were, among other things, working with a local heroin smuggler who would bring heroin in from Mexico and then sell it on the streets in what were described as controlled buy operations, but it just turns out they were protecting this guy while he was smuggling heroin and selling it on the streets. And then paying him from multiple accounts, multiple federal accounts, in order to keep him on the payroll and keep him protected. And they were using this to pad their statistics and to build their budget. And they were taking the budget at the end of the fiscal year and blowing it on every personal benefit and perk you can imagine, including junkets to places like Las Vegas, where a lot of these taxpayer funds ended up being stuffed down the G-string of strippers. That's the sort of thing that was going on in Deming in 2007. And I didn't have a chance to write about this, and this is something I'm probably going to write about not too terribly long from now, but there was a firearms dealership in Deming that in 2011 was raided by a SWAT team, and they were set up by the same Homeland Security Investigations Office using a Mexican drug smuggler whose last name was Roman as a confidential informant. They were trying to set up this family-owned federally licensed firearms dealership, trying to set them up on charges that they were working through a straw purchaser to sell guns to Mexican drug cartels. In other words, it was fast and furious type stuff. They were doing nothing of the sort. And after the case went to court, the federal prosecutors in the area obtained a motion from a complaisant federal judge to put everything under a seal so that discovery couldn't go forward and the public couldn't have access to the documents that would demonstrate that this whole thing was a completely phony operation, your familiar Homeland Security theater type operation, this time involving firearms rather than Muslim terrorism or narcotics. They ended up, the family in question, the Reese family, ended up being convicted of making false statements on federal forms, which is a very easy thing to do. Just go read Harvey Silverglate's book, Three Felonies Today, to show you how this works. They may have made technically factually inaccurate statements on disclosure forms, but there was nothing here that indicated that they were involved in illicit commerce or trying to cover up the same. On the other hand, the local border narcotics task force is doing that kind of thing all the time as a matter of common operations, and they get $8 to $10 million a year from the taxpayers to do so. And it's that border narcotics task force that was working with at least two of the officers who've been involved now on at least two occasions in conducting traffic stops that end up in the sexual torture of perfectly innocent citizens there in New Mexico.
Amazing. It's just amazing. Well, but listen, Will, I mean, there's some collateral damage here and all of that, but to run our society any other way would send the wrong message to the children.
Exactly. Unless the police have the supposed right and authority to conduct sexual rape of innocent people, society, as we know, will fall apart, and grass will start growing through the cracks of our untended streets, and dogs and cats will be living together and will be seized by mass hysteria or some such apocalyptic nonsense. That one of the things I keep trying to explain to people is that everything that the state does is antisocial. It undermines the rudimentary decencies that we owe each other as decent people, as reasonably civilized people, by authorizing certain people to inflict this kind of violence upon people who've done no harm to anybody. And I'm hoping at some point we'll reach a saturation level with outrage here, and that we will no longer countenance this type of behavior. But unfortunately, until people feel the sting of it personally, it seems to be too abstract and too theoretical to get their attention. And what's likely to happen here as a result of the lawsuit that's been filed on behalf of Mr. Eckerd is that the people responsible will invoke the spurious principle of qualified immunity. That's something that's in their reply. They concede most of the facts. Almost all the critical facts are conceded in the reply to the lawsuit by the city of Deming and the police officers involved. But they invoke qualified immunity here, which is a simple way of saying that they have some type of plenary indulgence to do this type of thing because they're police officers, and there'll be a settlement where the tax victims of Luna County and probably Hidalgo County will be required to indemnify the criminal actions of the officers involved. That's what usually happens here. And I'm hoping that somewhere, maybe in the state of Idaho where I live or some other state here in the West, there's going to be a legislative revolt against the principle of qualified immunity. That would start a really interesting fight with the police unions, and I think a fight like that would be worthwhile. And so you'll end up with a situation, hopefully, where somebody is going to say, listen, if we're going to allow police officers to carry out their function in society as it presently exists, and that's a horrible thing that I think needs to change, but if we're going to suffer their existence as a law enforcement body, they have to be individually, criminally, and civilly liable for their behavior the same way that any other citizen would be. And where you have lawsuits that result in settlements or in civil awards, that money needs to be taken out of the pension funds of the local law enforcement body. In other words, they've got skin in the game now. And that would be a very useful thing to do. I think it would be wonderful if 50 state legislatures next year, we had 50 fights with police unions over this issue, over the issue of qualified immunity and making police officers personally liable for both civil and criminal sanctions when they do this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I forgot the wonderful way that you put it there, Will. I can't even say that eloquently, but you were talking about people have to break from their sort of, I guess like the communists would say, the false consciousness about who these police officers are to us. And it's sort of just kind of a simple cognitive dissonance, right, between the law and order heroes on TV who only are here because they love you so much and want to protect you so much, and what you hear at least from time to time on the local news, which is they killed somebody else for apparently no reason. And I was thinking of this the other day, I'm sure you saw this, about the guy got in a fight with his son about wouldn't buy him a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
I guess the kid didn't have his ID, and the government says, well, you know, you can't have cigarettes. You can't buy cigarettes unless you look like you're 35 or older, or else you got to be carded. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So the kid stole the dad's truck, so the dad, and this is the dad's words, he's going to teach his boy a lesson by calling the cops on him. And, you know, in the dad's imagination, this is going to be like an episode of some sitcom that he watches where
exactly.
The police officer is some caring guy, and his son is going to go to jail for the night, and it's going to be a very special episode of their life and whatever, and everyone's going to learn a nice lesson. And then meanwhile, the execution squad comes and kills his kid. And then the grandfather, who probably fought in World War II or something, is standing there going, huh? What do you mean you just killed my grandson for no reason? You say he wouldn't turn the truck off. Maybe he didn't hear you yelling because his truck was still on. Did you think of that? They just killed the kid. And this happens, as well, you know, all the time. And, you know, I got my Facebook feed, And every single day, Will, every single day, cops kill at least somebody in America that was unarmed at the time, was no threat at the time, got shot in the back at the time, whatever it was. And those are only the ones that make the local news, that make my Facebook feed. And it's every single day. But people still believe in policeman the character, not their own real experience, which is, man, when you see these guys on the street, you're afraid of them, aren't you?
You should be. You should be afraid of anybody who claims the right to initiate force and then to escalate force if you resist to the point where you're physically extinct, which is how police officers are trained. They're indoctrinated in the belief that they are occupation soldiers confronting a 360-degree battlefront in which the most important consideration is force protection or officer safety. Here in the state of Idaho, I think I might have mentioned this to you before, Scott, back in 2007, December of that year, the Post Academy in Meridian had a graduating class that adopted as its official graduation slogan, "Don't suffer from PTSD, go out and cause some." And when this became a matter of some public scandal here, there was the perfunctory apology, but nobody in a position of authority did what I would consider to be the minimum necessary in order to placate the genuine outrage here, which would be to require that this entire graduating class go through its entire curriculum again and have that curriculum revised in order to reflect the fact that what their motto had suggested was nothing more or less than a type of psychotic inclination toward violence. Or they should have flunked them and banned them from being from getting peace officer certification. They still call themselves peace officers, and what they do, of course, has no colorable connection to the role of what a peace officer should actually do. But the public here, unfortunately, is living in this immersive environment of infotainment in which you have not only constant indoctrination by mass entertainment, Law and Order, and its many imitators, for instance, but also so-called reality TV, where this character, as you describe him, of the police officer, is ubiquitous, and the actual damage which is done by law enforcement is rarely, if ever, given any kind of widespread treatment. I don't expect this story from New Mexico is going to be receiving anything like the type of coverage, the type of saturation coverage, that other stories that would glamorize or valorize law enforcement intelligence would be given. And the other thing that I think is important in this connection here with respect to the public perception of what police do is that most people don't understand that no police officer is morally, certainly, but not civilly or legally required to come to the rescue of a citizen who's actually on the receiving end of aggressive violence. They have no individual duty to care for a citizen, in spite of the fact that that's how their services are advertised. And at the same time, they have no enforceable criminal or civil liability should they injure or kill that citizen. And so they're not required to help, and they're not held accountable when they hurt. And the other thing that we've talked about before with respect to the ubiquity of police violence against the innocent, as you say, Scott, this sort of thing happens every single day in this country. There are at least a handful of innocent people who are killed or otherwise horribly injured by police every single day for no legally defensible reason. But we're told that police work, as it's described, is incomparably dangerous, that it's an occupation in which these people live in constant peril all the time. And every time a police officer is killed, of course, we have this grotesque spectacle of a Brezhnevite state funeral where the public at large is told that we need to prostrate ourselves in mourning because one of the heroic paladins of public order has sacrificed himself on behalf of the community. But that is the sort of thing that happens with vanishing rarity. It's an enormously overstated peril that police officers face. It's not even in the top 10 or 12 most dangerous occupations as ranked by the federal bureaucracies in charge of making such calibrations, making such determinations. If you're a commercial fisherman or a farmer, if you're a truck driver or a logger, if you're a test pilot, if you do something, in other words, that actually adds to the aggregate wealth and benefit, to the benefit of society at large, you're in a more dangerous occupation than law enforcement by several orders of magnitude.
Well, and it's all just part of the same lie that they're the only thing standing between us regular folk and all of society tearing itself apart like some zombie movie. And,
exactly.
And we're just supposed to imagine that while we're sleeping at night, they're out there holding whichever hordes, I'm not sure which, at bay. And Yeah, oh, how dangerous it must be out in that part of town I never go to where you guys apparently spend all your time protecting me.
Yes, the uniforms that guard conceit, that, you know, each of us sleep soundly in our beds because rough men stand ready to do violence on our behalf. Those rough men stand ready to kill us in our beds. That's something I wrote about a couple of weeks ago. There's this really unfortunate but predictable trend toward police kicking in doors and shooting people in their beds. These are the rough men who supposedly guard us while we sleep, and I can't think of few thoughts that are likely to banish sleep from my eyes than the idea that there are people out there in government-issued costumes with government-issued license to invade my home and inflict violence upon me and my family. People don't see it that way, but I think that an ever larger cohort of people within the public are starting to understand what's really happening here, and we have our work cut out for us in terms of dispelling this decades-long accumulation of ideological fog that obstructs the vision of so many people, and more importantly, impedes them from calling things by their proper names. I was reading about this incident in Santa Rosa a couple of weeks ago, where this young man, Andy Lopez, was killed by a deputy sheriff by the name of Eric Gelhaus in a matter of seconds because this 13-year-old kid was carrying an airsoft rifle that the deputy thought looked like an actual AK-47. Basically, from teeth to tail, this incident took about 10 seconds. They called to report that they saw a suspicious guy who looked like he had a gun. They pulled up behind him. They whelped the horn once. The deputy came out of the car with his gun trained on the back of this young man and yelled, "Drop the gun." The young man turned to hear who it was who was ordering him to drop the gun because Gelhaus did not identify himself as a police officer. And as he turned, Gelhaus unloaded 7 shots into the kid's back. And in the media descriptions I read of this, particularly at execrable police propaganda sites like police1.com, they've used words like altercation or fracas or fight to describe an ambush and a murder by a police officer. Well, I'm happy to say that I'm seeing more and more frequently now, at least at some alternative media sites, the use of words such as assault rather than arrest or abduction rather than arrest, and referring to somebody as a victim rather than a suspect or a perpetrator, and to refer to these encounters as something other than fights or altercations when the police are unilaterally inflicting violence on a helpless and usually outnumbered citizen. So there's a bit, I think, of a revolution of awareness happening on the part of the public. That's a very healthy thing.
And you know what? I'm sorry because we're just completely out of time here, Will, but next time we should really talk about that legislative fight that we have to have, as you say.
All right.
You know, what it is that people can do, because I certainly agree with you that this is starting to get to regular people now that, like, wait a minute, you know, I thought you guys were on my side, but I ain't so sure no more, kind of a thing. And we have to run with that before more innocent people die. That's all. And that's it. We're out. Thanks very much, Will.
Take care, Scott.
All right, everybody. That is the heroic William Norman Greig, freedominourtime.blogspot.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. We're at Liberty Express and No Agenda Radio, and at my website, scotthorton.org. Of course, keep all my interview archives there as well. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. scotthorton.org. Join us in the chat room there during the show. scotthorton.org/chat. All right, enough of that. Next guest
is Roy Gutman from McClatchy Newspapers. Welcome back to the show. Roy, how are you doing?
Good, Scott, and glad to be on the show.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here, and you are in Geneva, Switzerland right now, correct?
Yes. In fact, I'm here watching the Iran nuclear talks, which are halfway through the two-day period.
So I read this. I believe this is your most recent piece. U.S.-Iran hope to reach deal by Friday on nuclear program. And I didn't frown a single time in the whole thing. It sounds like they're really going to do it. You couldn't find anybody saying, oh, I don't know.
Well, I mean, in a sense, look, this has been a decade in the making. There have been a lot of ups and downs, mostly downs. The relationship has been extremely tense at times. Iran has been building up its stockpiles of uranium that has been purified to a very high degree, much more than they really need, and in quantities far beyond what they need. And there's a lot of worry that they're sliding toward a nuclear weapon. So I think the idea now is better stop it while you can before things get worse. And it's going to require some real compromises, I think, on the part of the Western countries and Russia and China.
Oh, I'm sorry. Certainly one way of looking at it. It seemed to me more like the Westerners have been completely impossible and have thus far refused up until now to recognize Iran's right to a civilian nuclear program, that their 20% uranium stockpile was mostly just for their American-built medical isotope reactor, and the rest is just the bargaining chip for just this purpose, something to trade for a lifting of sanctions and something like a security guarantee from the Americans, right?
You know, that's sort of the narrative that the Iranian government has, and, you know, one can understand elements of it. But as a matter of fact, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to have a huge quantity, something like 6 metric tons of low-enriched uranium that they say would be used for nuclear power reactors when they only have one reactor, and that's supplied by Russia, and the fuel is supplied by Russia. So they really didn't need it for that purpose. And as for the high-enriched or middle-enriched uranium to 20%, they have a sizable quantity, something like 400 kilos, 400 pounds, I guess it is, 200 kilos. It's not really clear that this is the absolutely needed fuel for that reactor either. In fact, I've talked to experts who say it really is not. So there's a lot of question marks about why the Iranians have carried out this program. And, I've tried very hard this past week to get some explanations, and I don't think that any explanation is going to be complete. But the point is that there are real questions about what Iran has been doing, why it's been doing it, what its goals have been, and how to make sure that Iran's future operations in the field of nuclear energy or rather nuclear materials are directed exclusively to civilian purposes.
Well, and that's the whole thing is for a time there anyway, they were voluntarily abiding by the additional protocol back, 2003 through 5. And it seems like this time I talked with your colleague in profession, I know not for the same publications there, but Barbara Slavin was on the show, and she brought what was at least one version of the Iranian initial proposal. And it seemed like a real substantive thing, and it also seems like from watching the representatives on CNN International and so forth of the American side that, you know, they're quite cautiously, I guess, but quite optimistic too. And seem to think that they're going to be able to work out a deal where Iran, you know, basically the outline of the deal that everybody has known all along, that they'll stop enriching up to 20%, that they'll, you know, limit some enrichment or the number of centrifuges here, that they'll sign the additional protocol or at least abide by it again or something like that, right? And then everybody's happy. And it seems like they seem to be working it out, no? I mean, you're the one who's there.
Well, I'm not sure that all that's going to happen tomorrow. You know, Zarif, the Javad Zarif, who's the foreign minister, was on television on a couple of different channels today, and he was talking about, you know, and everybody's really talking about a first step, a preliminary agreement, one that might cover the next 6 months. It'll have some confidence-building measures. It might require, I don't think, you know, the Iranians are insisting, and this is really the news here, they've insisted that they have the right under the development of peaceful nuclear uses, that they have the right to enrich, and they are not going to give away that right, and they're not going to really stop enriching. That doesn't mean that they won't actually do it, but they're going to insist on having those rights. And what is likely to happen in these talks is that that right is going to be implicitly recognized by the United States and the other five countries who are in, they call this the P5, you know, the permanent representatives to the UN Security Council, plus Germany, and the P5 plus one. And so there's about to be a really major session made, at least implicitly, that Iran does have the right that it has claimed to enrich nuclear material, and that's that. So, the argument the Iranians make is that in all the time that the U.S. and other countries have demanded that Iran cease enriching and that it turn over all of the nuclear fuel it has to other countries, that Iran has ignored, and under ever-growing international sanctions. That, as a matter of fact, Iran is only instead, because it's rejected that approach, it's its pressure, that Iran has increased the number of centrifuges, increased its stockpiles, and basically gone, you know, straight ahead with a program that, quite honestly, Scott, does not make a huge amount of sense for its own sake, but it might make some sense in the game that has been played. You know, the zero-sum game that's been played between the West, Russia and China, and Iran. So, in a sense, what's going to happen is that the Iranian case, which is recognize what we do, accept what we do, we will actually try to adjust what we're doing to meet your concerns about what our goal is, and you'll see that things are going to get a lot better fast. And but we, the Iranians, need sanctions relief at the same time in order to convince the Iranian people that this is a good idea. And there's a lot of distrust from Iran to the West, and there's a lot of distrust, obviously, from the West to Iran. So we're about to enter a period, it seems to me, of trying out this thesis. And one can only be hopeful that this is going to work. But believe me, this is really a new territory.
Yeah. Well, I got a good feeling about it, and I think that. Regardless of what any one of us thinks about whether it makes sense for them to continue enriching up to 3.6% or not, that kind of thing, it clearly is something that they're very determined to hang on to, is their right to do so, and probably even their right to actually continue to do so, not just to sort of metaphysically have that right, but they want to continue exercising that right. And it seems to me like trading that for even more inspections, when in fact all their nuclear material is safeguarded, and back under the old additional protocol between 03 and 05, they had determined, the IAEA had determined, there's no other nuclear material in the country other than what is safeguarded. So as long as we have the safeguards agreement and plus the additional protocol on the one side, then it seems like 3.6%, I'm trying to be objective here, Roy, 3.6% trade-off on the other side, you guys go ahead and continue that, I guess, sort of a thing. That seems like a pretty reasonable deal for both sides to accept and sell to their own hawks back home.
Well, yes, you're right in theory. There's no question, Scott, this is a departure from the past. Essentially the Iranians are being told, okay, you're making an argument that you can be trusted, and that you're going to observe all of the safeguards, and you're going to allow the inspectors to do everything they want to do, and you're going to build up, you know, we'll try it for a spin, we'll see if it works. And at this point in the standoff between the other countries and Iran, it probably does make sense to try it, but I have a feeling, quite honestly, of a gamble, you know, of doing something that hadn't been tried before, and nobody knows if it's going to work. Right. Now, one of the reasons why you, in fact, might be very reasonable in having, you know, in being optimistic here, is that Iran's government has changed in a major way. The election of Rouhani in June, and I actually covered that election, by the way, it's a really major change in Iran's political leadership. And while a lot of people here, you know, reasonably have been skeptical that Rouhani actually can change the direction of Iran's policies, he's shown himself to be a very adept man who has the understanding and the support of the supreme leader, although he obviously has a lot of enemies in the very complex Iranian political scene as well. But, you know, you have, and this is what Zarif, the foreign minister, said in an interview tonight on Christiane Amanpour's program on CNN, you know, you have a chance here. You have a new government. The people of Iran wanted a government that really wants to come to terms with the international community, wants to end the sanctions, wants to reach understandings on the nuclear program. You have this chance. Don't throw it away. And I think that actually is one of the most important reasons that the Western countries and the other participants are willing to take what I think is a calculated gamble.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, that's just what I was going to ask you, because it seems to me like even if the terms of the deal are sort of sketchy and it's a gamble the way you say and all that, it's sort of like just, you know, having the big handshake. Making any deal at all is a step toward making many more deals and getting terms much more refined to everybody's liking and that kind of thing. But it seems like, you know, one small step for a State Department weenie, one huge step for American-Iranian relations after 35 years of Cold War.
You know, when you think about it, the relationship between the United States and Iran, other than North Korea, is really the most strained in the world. And it is really, or maybe Syria right now as well, it is absolutely at loggerheads. You know, the tensions are completely beyond belief. I mean, there is no U.S. embassy in Tehran after 35 years. There's no people-to-people exchanges, you know, scholarships, journalistic exchanges. Everything is sort of reduced to the absolute minimum. And Iran is really an important country. It's not just because it's an oil producer, but it is an anchor in the Gulf. It has very important neighbors. You know, one of its neighbors is Afghanistan, and another is Saudi Arabia. And the Gulf itself is a place that if the war were to come for any reason, and the tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran have at times led people to think that war is a real possibility, you know, the disaster for the world is just hard to describe. It's not just oil prices going up. It's everything becoming chaotic. So trying to resolve this, you know, this fundamental difference between the U.S. and Iran, and Iran and the rest of the world, especially over its nuclear program, but really there are many, many other issues, is really a top priority. I think the Obama administration, you know, we all have thoughts that they're pretty ineffective in a lot of places, and they have a hands-off policy in places where they might have hands-on. Like Syria, that they do, however, have the priorities straight in addressing Iran as, in a way, the sort of the supreme issue of the day. Yeah. And that if we could solve this out, sort this out, they might be able to solve other problems as well. So that's why, you know, a lot more hangs on this tentative preliminary agreement than just simply Iran's nuclear policy.
Right. Well, you know, 4 years ago, they were doing this. October 09, it all fell apart. It didn't go anywhere. And then the deadline was up and more sanctions kicked in and all of this. And just from the center of Texas here, Roy, without being able to really tell beyond the headlines, it sure does seem to me like Washington, D.C. really wants this time, or at least the Obama administration has certainly decided that they mean it and they want to see this through. In 09, it seemed more like they wanted to stall for time until they could get more sanctions in place. But this time it seems different, no?
Scott, I wrote about, I did some research on what happened in 09 because the really
Oh, and I'm sorry, we're almost out of time too, so go real fast, Roy, sorry.
Sure. There was a chance then. I think it was a huge surprise when Brazil and Turkey actually reached what looked like an agreement with Iran, and the administration instead decided to go for sanctions the next day at the UN. Mm-hmm. Why they did it, who knows? I think it was a mistake. But maybe they tried to make up for it right now.
Yep, sure seems like it. Hey, listen, thank you so much for your reporting. I sure appreciate it, Roy.
Okay, Scott, nice to talk to you. Take care.
All right, everybody, that is Roy Guttman. He writes for McClatchy Newspapers. He's in Geneva, Switzerland right now covering the Iran talks. U.S.-Iran hope to reach deal by Friday. McClatchyDC.com. We'll be right back.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. This is my show. Next up is Eric Garris, a.k.a. Boss Man. He is the founder and everything of antiwar.com. And, of course, all the big headlines are that the FBI, Eric, has been investigating you for years because they misunderstood a simple email. Is that right? Welcome to the show.
Well, yes, it is. It sounds kind of like a funny story, but it isn't.
It's not funny when it's about you, right?
And it's not the only reason that they are investigating us. It was just one of the reasons given for targeting us.
Right. Well, and it seemed to kind of, I'll let you tell the whole thing, but underlying it all was, yeah, and one time this Garris guy threatened us is basically, you know, the story of the entire investigation, right?
Well, I mean, the investigation revolves around revelations that Justin Raimondo made several years ago about possible Israeli knowledge of 911. But that was all analyzing documents that were on the internet and were accessible to anyone. But the other, actually the most alarming part, which came out in the latest documents, is the fact that one of the reasons they're targeting us is for statements that were made in mainstream media by our spokespeople. And that's really dangerous. But the incident that everybody's focusing on is quite amazing. In the day after 9/11, we received a threatening email saying that they were going to take down our site. And I mistakenly thought that the best thing to do would be to report that to the FBI in case that developed into something. The FBI took the report, asked me to forward the email, and 4 months later, an analyst was reading the report and the email, didn't understand how to read a forwarded email, and wrote that I had threatened to take down the FBI website. And then that, and the concluding statement was that I was a known threat to national security and that I should be watched.
Right. Well, they
and,
equated...
and that particular statement is now in several other government documents without the reference to what actually happened.
Well, they even equated
that's really scary.
A threat to take down their website with a threat to take down their entire system. Right? They conflated
right.
those two things.
It's as if I had called the local police and said, I've been robbed, and instead of putting my name down under victim, they put my name down under perpetrator.
Right. And then, so what's the deal with these documents? Now, it was FBI documents of original initial suspect lists from the FBI that surfaced. They'd been leaked, I think, by Italian banks, right? The FBI had been passing them around European banks, and that was how they got into the public domain. And then Justin just linked to it and said, aha, Mossad agents are on this list.
Yes, and they made it sound as if Justin was disseminating classified information, when in fact the information was available on the internet and was being referred to by Carl Cameron in a four-part Fox News report.
Right.
Prior to Justin even writing about it.
Right. And so then what did this investigation amount to? Because I think... I hope it's okay to say, when you sued them, you asked them, we'll turn over information that you have on Scott Horton, too, and they said, who the hell is he?
Right. We listed all of the, we had all of the antiwar.com staff fill out requests, and they said, we don't have anything on Scott Horton, we don't have anything on Jason Ditz, etc. But in the case of Justin and I, they were mum.
Oh, great. Now I'm on the list, too. Thanks a lot.
So we made three FOIA requests and got nothing. And then when we sued, the first thing they said was, we don't have to give you anything because it's all protected, exempted documents that can't be released because of national security. And even the latest documents we got, which are close to 100 pages, 90% of it is redacted, so we still don't know what is in most of them and what they're saying about us.
Well, the good news is the story broke all over again, and everybody cares this time.
Yes, they care because it made it into an interesting story, the FBI making a mistake. Mm. The unfortunate thing is that many people see this as a conclusion, and in fact, this is just opening the case wide open.
Right.
Because the really important part is that they saw Justin writing anti-government essays, and they saw our spokespeople appearing on MSNBC saying things that were not appreciated by the powers that be as a national security threat. That basically they have inflated First Amendment activities into suspicious, if not criminal, activities.
Right, and see, that's the criminal part of what they did, is they've used their national security powers, which is a much lower threshold of evidence, a so-called reasonable belief, as opposed to probable cause, to even continue investigating you, too, right?
That's correct. And, you know, the one point is that as far as we know, the investigation, although we have evidence it went on for 6 years, we don't know that it's ended. And number two, much more is being done today than was done 5-6 years ago in terms of surveillance of people and in terms of targeting people who say things against the government.
Right. Well, and this does fit in with what we had found out already about even the military being used to watch some anti-war groups, right?
That's right. These agencies are work together, and they share information, and they assign the duties of who's going to target, harass, and interfere with people in different ways. So you have the FBI doing one thing, the IRS doing another, the military doing another, the NSA doing another, all targeting everyone.
Right. All right, everybody, that's Eric Garris. He's the founder and the webmaster and the everything running antiwar.com over there. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, so listen, go to antiwar.com right now, guys, and the top headline is FBI monitored antiwar.com for 6 years. That's Spencer Ackerman. And then there's the ACLU press release. And then Marcy Wheeler, of course, has a brilliant write-up. And there's another one at techdirt.com. That's really worth looking at. This is a very important story. It just happens to be about our guys. So check it out. Antiwar.com today. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Oh, man. God dang, that's reminding me of old days. Which is amazing. Isn't it amazing how quickly present days become old days? All right. Thanks, guys, for that one.
All right, welcome back to the show here. So, here's what I want to talk about the most. Man, I think they're really going to make this Iran deal. I think the Democrats have actually decided that they're going to do this. And you know what? One of my pieces of evidence, well, first of all, my biggest piece of evidence is just my tummy and the way it feels. I just know that this is, I don't want to overstate it too bad. But no, I got a pretty damn good feeling about this. That's what I mean to say about it. And a pretty damn good feeling about it. And then my ridiculously flimsy piece of evidence that I'll cite for you that comes to mind right now that sort of reinforced the feeling in my tummy was this thing in the New York Times that ran about a week ago about Susan Rice, who's now the National Security Advisor, and how she led a review of all Mideast policy. And the way they described it was she got a few of her flunkies and they sat around over at some office building with, a whiteboard and some markers. And they said, what are we even doing over in the Middle East anyway? Let's just start over and look at it. And the thing of it is I know that that's retarded and you know that that's retarded. We all know that there are 10 zillion interests involved in America's Middle East policy. And so the degree to which this meeting even really happened the way that they describe it and who all was invited to it and who all had what instructions before they showed up at it and what, who knows? I don't know. I almost sort of kind of believe it happened more or less like they put it. Obama told Susan Rice, go over there and sort of start over. And I don't know. It's only just because it's so easy for me to picture it that it rings true to me. That they decided that what they want to do is they want to solve the Iran thing and the Palestine thing. And they don't care about Libya. They're not going to try to intervene, get entrenched further into Libya, which I'm not saying rule that out. It's not on their agenda anyway. They think they know better. Oh, thank God. I really liked reading that part. I sure hope it's true. And then just when I was reading it, I was thinking, well, you know what? I think they really have decided, hey, the Iran thing, you want to go ahead and do that? Yeah, let's go ahead and do it this time. You really want to? Yeah, okay. All right. And they did it. And they decided to do it. And then on the, yeah, and let's solve the Palestine thing, that just was funny, right? That's just the, oh, yeah, and also we'll solve the Palestine thing. Yeah, oh, okay, yeah, you sure will. It's the childishness that was necessary for them to make the decision to, huh, yeah, let's go ahead and make peace with Iran, is the same stupidity that would have them think that they can do a damn thing about the West Bank. But I'll take it. And you know what? Who knows the whole future? I don't know. It could be that peace with Iran leads to a Chinese invasion of Mongolia that leads to nuclear winter. And, who knows what will happen in the world? I'm just making things up, obviously. I don't know where. Who knows what really will happen? But it seems like promoting good and trying to oppose evil is the right thing to do, for the most part. And never know exactly how it's going to be. I'm thinking now of this leak that the Saudis are saying, oh yeah, well, we'll just buy a nuke from the Pakistanis then. Or it's really the Israelis saying, I don't. Anyway, I think it's a good thing. I certainly don't think that it's wise to believe that any scaremongering thing any warmongers ever said, any words about Iran that you've ever heard from anything to the right of, say, Jimmy Carter, it's all lies. I mean, other than the American Conservative magazine, you can find good stuff there, but that's, of course, the exception. But all the right think tanks, right-wing think tanks, so-called conservative think tanks, and all their magazines, the National Review, the Weekly Standard, and the Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal editorial pages, and all these things, they're so full of it. Oh my God, all the reasons that they tell you to be afraid of Iran are such lies. And you know, you might have noticed that Iran still doesn't have nuclear weapons. So if all the people who were accusing them of making nuclear weapons all this time had ever been right, we all could figure out by just looking at the time on our phones that they'd have had a few by now, right? But they don't, because they never were making them, because those people were lying. But anyway, I don't know what's gotten into them. I'm sorry I even bother referring to that New York Times article, because I know it sounds silly that it could be that simple. I mean, maybe it's just because they didn't really explain the reasoning behind it that much. I mean, if you hear me talking with all these Iran guests on the show, I'm always saying, hey, this is everything. You know, right now, the reason our government, and the Israelis for that matter, the Turks, everybody's back in Al-Qaeda in Syria, is to try to check Iranian power in Syria and in southern Lebanon. Well, if we befriend the Iranians, that's even better than killing them all. That neutralizes the whole thing. It's just like when they did the move to make friends with the Chinese, it made it not matter so much that they had lost Vietnam, because now the whole domino theory and everything had been preempted. The first big domino, China, was now friendly domino. And so who cares if they all fall over? It'll be like Vietnam is now, right? A friendly communist dictatorship with really, really low wages for the American consumer goods that they produce, right? Same kind of thing here. Who cares about Hezbollah's relationship with Iran when the Iranians and the Americans are walking around shaking hands all day? They can make deals like no more guns for Hezbollah. Hezbollah's the most bit player in the whole world in all of this. There certainly would be no impediment to the Iranians' intentions to get along with the Americans, especially if it's working. Just go back to 2003 and the golden offer, the burnt offering, or whatever you call it. 2003, the Iranians said, let's deal with it on everything. It was Khatami's administration then. They said, let's deal on the entire issue of the nuclear program. Every facet of the nuclear program we'll talk about. Whether to have it at all is on the table for discussion then, 10 years ago, 10 and a half. This is the one that they sent through the Swiss ambassador. They said Hamas and Hezbollah will politely encourage them to become political parties, to disarm and simply become political parties under the Palestinian Authority, under the Lebanese government. We'll disarm them. And, you're invading Iraq right now to install the Supreme Islamic Council in power? Great, we'll help you with that. just so happens the Bada Brigade has been living in Iran for 30 years. And on and on it went. And, of course, they had already been cooperating up until then on the entire war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And had arrested numerous Al-Qaeda guys who had fled the American war in Afghanistan, including one of bin Laden's sons. And including this guy, Atef, who, the last I heard, there he was still on the run and could be a problem. They had held him forever until finally an Iranian diplomat was kidnapped in Pakistan by the Al-Qaeda guys. And they said, you have to give us this guy Atef or whatever to get your ambassador back. So here the Iranians, who had tried to give this Al-Qaeda up to the Americans almost 10 years before, 9 years before, or 8 and a half or something years before, were finally in the position where, well, had no choice, had to let him go in order to get their ambassador back. Or their diplomat, anyway. I don't think it was their ambassador. But these are the... Just like Roy Gutman said, yeah, you know, back when they wanted a deal before, they didn't even really have a nuclear program. Now they've got all of these, however many metric tons of this or that quality enriched. The sanctions didn't work. All this time we've been threatening them with sanctions. You hear all these people beating their chests and crowing out, yeah, the sanctions are working, bringing them, forcing them to the table and all that. Well, really, they've developed their entire nuclear program that you're screaming about under the sanctions regime. So what does that tell you? Even since the sanctions that Obama, as we're talking about at the very end of the interview with Roy there, pushed aside the Brazilian and Turkish deal that was a perfectly good deal in the beginning of 2010 and decided to do sanctions instead then. They've made incredible progress just since that time. I don't know all the exact measurements, but if you read the occasional IAEA report, you'll know that they're steadily been advancing. And now, I don't know if anybody maybe in the chat room knows or what. I hadn't heard. Maybe I should send a tweet to... our friend Barbara Slavin, reporter for Al Monitor now, about whether her original report held up. She was the first to say that, hey, this is a single source story. I'm not swearing by it. I'm publishing it because I think it's newsworthy, but here are all the caveats and disclaimers. This is not official, and I don't know for a fact. However, this has been leaked to me as the Iranians' initial proposal. Remember, she was on the show a week ago talking about that, or a week and a half ago or something. But I hadn't heard anything more about that. I certainly hadn't heard that that story had fallen apart or been retracted or anything, which I think I probably would have heard. I think that is, we can pretty much count on that being a pretty fair renditioning of the Iranian proposal this time, which again is not all about Hamas, Hezbollah, and everything, but just on the nuclear issue now. But what they're saying is they'll turn Fordo, the Boohoo extra enrichment facility that the Americans are so concerned about, that they'll turn that into a simple research facility. They'll cease all enrichment of 20% uranium. They'll seek help in transferring the 20% enriched uranium they have into fuel plates for use in the reactors, basically diminishing the so-called breakout capability or the pseudo breakout capability that they've achieved, diminishing it, taking it, negotiating it away. Which is really the only reason they built it in the first place. It's not like they think that they could build a nuke before America nuked them. And then they're going to limit their amount of 3.6%. As Roy said, they already got more than enough of the 3.6% to last them forever. They only need to enrich enough just to prove that they still can, which is fine. And which, as he said, and this is my feeling about this too, the Americans are willing to implicitly ignore the UN Security Council resolution that demands all ceasing of uranium enrichment and go ahead and implicitly recognize their right to enrich uranium as long as they remain under the safeguards and probably officially under the additional protocol to their safeguards agreement. And so, there's no one in the world to cry about it but Benjamin Netanyahu. Speaking of which, guess who's crying about it? Benjamin Netanyahu. Finally, after 35 years or whatever, I'm no good at math, 34 years of Cold War, and the damned Democrats of all people are actually going to try to finally end all this strife and the closing of this relationship and all this enmity. From news.antiwar.com, Netanyahu warns Kerry against any Iran deal. Secretary of State John Kerry's latest visit to Israel coincides with reports that the latest P5+1 talks with Iran could end with an interim agreement, providing another opportunity for Israeli officials to reiterate their opposition to such a deal, whatever it is. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took time out from talks on the stalled peace process with the Palestinians to warn Kerry against any deal with Iran, particularly one that would involve a pause in new sanctions against them. Netanyahu reiterated his position that new sanctions were needed whenever Iran was enriching uranium, even though U.S. officials have already conceded that civilian enrichment of uranium was not a problem in and of itself. Indeed, all the problems with Iran's civilian nuclear program begin and end with Israeli objections to it. And since Israel is objecting to any deal that doesn't involve a total surrender by Iran, it's hard to see how the U.S. will ever be able to sign on to a deal without dismissing Israeli concerns at some point as unreasonable. And what an important point, right? That Benjamin Netanyahu is delegitimizing the Israeli state in more eyes every day, or at least their ridiculous policy and his ridiculous stances. You know, isn't there such a thing as a critical mass of eyes rolling? A critical mass of people saying, don't even bother listening to that guy, he's a clown. And the things that he says, they're lies. Hell, a friend, a Facebook friend sent me a link to a Yahoo News thing. Fact check Israeli claims about Iran's nuclear program. Oh my God, are you kidding me? Not just some claims, maybe Republican claims, but Israeli Benjamin Netanyahu claims on Iran's nuclear program? And then they just quote him to shoot him down. They give him one quote that he's right about just to say he's right about something so they're not being mean or biased or anti-Semitic. But, it was something innocuous anyway. The whole thing's ridiculous, so. Anyway. Good times, man. And now, it's not over yet, and there are still horrible people in Congress who, I guess, could try to do something, but I'm not really sure what they can do. I don't think they have the votes to override Obama's veto of any sanctions they pass at this point. And I have read a few stories here and there about Obama sending his people from the White House. And this is something he hasn't been very good at doing, even on things that he wants done, typically. But sending his people, I guess John Kerry, especially the Secretary of State, to Capitol Hill, where, of course, Kerry's been a senator since forever ago, the 80s. To ask them politely to knock it off for a week or so, okay, while we're doing this thing we're trying to do. And it's not perfect, but I think they have called off a few of the congressional dogs that, like, you know, the Democrats at least, and not all of them. It's not like you can count on Chuck Schumer or something. But, anyway. As Roy Gutman said, this is not going to be a wide-ranging thing. It's only going to be on the nuclear issue, and in fact, it's only going to be a first step on the nuclear issue, but it will be tomorrow. It's looking like. Only a first step, but that's it. Huge step. Huge step in dealing with Iran. You know, Was it Christopher Hill or Ryan Crocker or one of these State Department weenies from the Bush years wrote a thing the other day for the New York Times saying, do it, man, make the deal, talk with Iran, it's all right. All these people saying don't talk with them, nah, ignore all that, don't worry about it, do it. They're all right, man. Not they're all right, they're horrible, but still talk with them. That's what he said. And it must have been Christopher Hill, I think, because he would have been the guy who dealt with them in Iraq in 2006 and 7, after Khalil Saad, he was next, right? No, wait, Christopher Hill was the guy that went to North Korea. Was it Ryan Crocker? I think it was Ryan Crocker, no. One of these State Department guys wrote a thing in the paper saying, go ahead and talk to them. And, you know, he could have finished the statement with all this stuff about you can't talk to them because of how religious they are in a religion you don't believe in or something. It's so stupid and horrible. And, in fact, bigotedly stupid. And I don't mean, like, that's the worst thing about it is that it hurts someone's feelings or whatever. But I mean that it's the kind of prejudice that overrides any critical thinking at all. And let's face it, the supreme leader of Iran wears a funny hat and claims religious authority over the people of Iran. What the hell kind of crap is that for the 21st century, for anyone in the world? I mean, not the hat part, but the claim of religious authority. But that doesn't mean that he's anything but a politician in a funny hat. Come on, man. They're just politicians. And even if he, you know, truly believes in his faith or whatever, that doesn't mean... Here's what it certainly doesn't mean. That you should go ahead and trust right-wing hawks in America when they tell you that the Iranians are willing to sacrifice their entire country to nuclear fire and permanent extinction as a civilization in order to fulfill the demands of their insane Shiite Ayatollah God. That is just so retarded. It ain't true. It just isn't. Which means that the people who tell you that are either lying to you or they're somebody who's been lied to and is repeating it like an idiot. So you definitely don't want to believe them, because then you're the fool who follows the fool. And that's worse. The Ayatollah and all of his merry men over there butchers all. They're politicians. And what's the number one rule of politics I've been teaching you ever since your first day when you came to Coruscant? Those with power will do anything to keep it. In other words, the day after the revolution is won, its leaders become conservative. That's all. It means just like everybody with wealth and or power, they want to hang on to what they've already got. Imagine that. So, in other words, deal with them. And anybody says, oh no, you can't deal with them, that's ridiculous. You don't have to listen to people who say those things anymore. It's nonsense. But anyway, damn Democrats, man. You know? It's not that this would undo any of the other horrible things that Barack Obama has done. All the other people he's killed, all the horrible laws he's passed and enforced and everything else. But man, this would be the single best thing of his entire presidency, that's for sure. They say that his legacy was supposed to be this Obamacare thing. Change the subject, Mr. President. Make a deal with Iran, okay? And then give a big speech about how you brought peace. About how you finally broke the ice on this horrible frozen relationship of mistrust and enmity and assassinations that has gone on for 35 years. And then I'll clap for it. I mean, I'll still hate the guy, but I will sure praise the deed. This is huge. Could be. Would be. And I don't know who could stop it, really. I don't think Netanyahu could stop it now. And I don't think the Republicans could stop it either. I don't think the Democrats in the Congress can stop it.
It's amazing. I cannot wait to not have this issue to complain about anymore. It's going to be interesting to see the aftermath of, you know, who chooses whose sides and who fights over what and what. But if relations can get warmed up and stay that way, that's going to be good news. And, you know, I guess, will the Hawks still be able to claim that their civilian nuclear program has anything to do with nuclear weapons after this deal? I mean, that talking point will be dead now. You got to admit, and listen, this is not an advertisement for voting. Far be it from me to participate in this democracy or anything. But you got to admit, the Republicans are so much worse on this. That if it was McCain or Mitt Romney there, man, we'd have had a full-scale war in Syria and or Iran by now. Well, I think McCain would have got us all killed in hydrogen bomb annihilation. You know, just because he wants to be a big man like his grandpa or whatever stupidity. Mitt Romney, I think, is a weasel, but he's the kind of weasel who would weasel us into war rather than out of one, I think. I think we could pretty much take it for granted that on the war with Iran issue, man, if you have to choose a party on this one, I'm going with the Dems. For now, for today, we'll see what happens tomorrow. But John McCain or Mitt Romney, we'd have had a war in Syria, and then this wouldn't even have been possible, this meeting. In the middle of a war with Syria. Can you imagine having the Americans invade Syria boots on the ground McCain style? George W. Bush style? All over again? Still, screw the Democrats and everything. And I hate Obama more than you, and since before you did too. Well, actually, that may not be true. Some of you may have seen him give a speech back before I ever did. But I can prove that I've hated him since the first day I ever heard of him. Because the next day, I was on the radio saying, have you guys ever heard of this Barack Obama guy? I hate his guts, because I saw him on TV and they were saying I supposedly love him because of what a wonderful, heroic, democratic rock star he is. Hope he gets in a car crash. And that was in January of 07. So, it's not like I'm saying anything good about the president, really, but I've got silence where some criticism would have gone, I guess, today. I think they're going to do this Iran thing. I'm excited. What can I say? I've been waiting for something like this for a long time. Sure is a hell of a lot better than carpet bombing, don't you think? And, by the way, yeah, Ariel Sharon, just as suspected, poisoned Yasser Arafat to death with polonium. We're going to cover that on the show a little bit more tomorrow, I think. And also, there's a new report out about death squads in Afghanistan. Lots more news on the show to cover tomorrow. So, see you then. Thanks for listening.